from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. On June 28th, 2 days ahead of schedule, the United States handed authority to a new interim government in Baghdad and announced to the world a new day in Iraq. 5.5 weeks later, U.S. military deaths in Iraq are up, moving quickly toward 1,000. 5,000 wounded. Insecurity runs high. Rebuilding runs slow. A critical national conference preparing for elections has been postponed. And yesterday, a truce with the radical Shiite leader Muqtada al-Sadr exploded into fierce fighting in Najaf and clashes around the country. Formal Iraq and American statements profess confidence in the face of insurgency, and there are reasons for hope. But there is also deep worry about Iraq's future and the future of America's role there. Tonight on Point, we'll hear from some of the longest-serving U.S. Army reservists just back from Iraq. But first, we'll look at the latest eruption of fighting and the status of the Bush administration's overall effort in Iraq. Joining me now from Washington is Anthony Cordesman, Senior Fellow and Security Analyst at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He's author of The Iraq War, Strategy, Tactics, and Military Lessons. Good evening and welcome, Anthony Cordesman.
Good evening.
Also with us tonight from Baghdad, Rod Nordland, Baghdad Bureau Chief for Newsweek magazine. Rod Nordland, thanks for joining us there.
Pleasure.
And with us from Baghdad, Chris Albritton, reporter for Time magazine. Chris, thanks so much for joining.
Hi, Tom.
Rod Nordland, if I may turn first to you, just to update us on the latest with Muqtada al-Sadr, very fierce fighting yesterday in Najaf, and we're told again today he called then for a national uprising. Today we hear his spokesman very critical of the U.S., but saying they're prepared to resume a truce. What's going on with this latest outburst and the apparent collapse of the truce?
Yeah, well, and I think since then they've also renounced the truce as well. I mean, today was probably the heaviest day of fighting that they've had in Najaf. Certainly since April and maybe since the whole conflict with Sadr started. The Marines say that they killed 300 of his militiamen. They insist that that's an accurate figure, and if that's true, it's probably the bloodiest single engagement of the war.
300, a huge number for one day.
Huge number. They can't verify that with bodies, but they say the colonel in charge of the Marine forces down in Najaf insists that that's accurate.
And Chris Albritton, does this show signs of spreading to other Iraqi cities in more intensity? We know there was bombing yesterday, we're told, by U.S. aircraft of areas of Baghdad itself, of Sadr City, and casualties reported by the Iraqi government there. What's the situation outside Najaf?
Yeah, there's some reports that American planes had fired some rockets into Sadr City, variously described as either rockets or bombs. We don't seem to really know what it was. And there's reports of 34 dead in Sadr City since yesterday. You know, it's hard to say how widely this can spread. I mean, Muqtada al-Sadr has a lot of support all over the south, as far south as Basra. We're hearing Amara is pretty much completely in control of the Jaish Mahdi. Nasiriya, Karbala, a couple of other neighborhoods in Baghdad. But it's hard to know how long this is going to last. I mean, the institutional knowledge in the military rests with the Sunnis and the Baathists, and they're mainly operating out west. These are basically a bunch of street thugs, and there's a lot of them, and they're getting money and weapons, but they're not as disciplined as the other insurgents.
And yet we saw in late spring just how shaky things could get when this so-called Mahdi army was really called out by al-Sadr. Anthony Cordesman in Washington, you're watching on. This is one development in a great mural of developments here. You've been writing just today saying that many aspects of the U.S. aid program in creating a new government, in providing security, in economic assistance have so far been a failure. How do you see this latest eruption, and what's the broader picture here? Are we headed toward some kind of greater stability and progress or not?
Well, so far there is a remarkable consistency to the statistics involved, because if you look at the patterns and what the United States is reporting as major and minor incidents, while they fluctuate by day and a little by month, the relative intensity in terms of numbers is the same, although the pattern of whether it is kidnappings, whether they are killing Iraqis or Americans, or it's bombings, these things do change. There's no evidence whatsoever that we are winning. There's no evidence that we are losing. But it's obvious that if we were to lose the Shiites, we would effectively lose any real hope in Iraq. But as both correspondents pointed out, Sadr is not the Shiites. At least on paper, he doesn't even have the largest militia. That still would be the Badr Brigades and the forces for the Supreme Council on the Iraqi Resistance. It's also not clear just how much popular support there is for Sadr. He's often able to essentially move into a power vacuum inside Shiite cities because the government isn't strong enough, but he can't deal with the U.S. forces. There are some more disturbing patterns. The movement of trucks in from Turkey and Jordan has been cut back to a very, very limited flow. There are major resupply problems building up in the country. And certainly, as you mentioned, the U.S. statistics on the flow of aid, both to the Iraqi security forces and in every area of the economic dimensions, are extremely discouraging.
Despite U.S. reports, you describe, for example, the USAID report, A Year in Iraq Restoring Services, which went through March of this year, as, to quote you, Anthony Cordesman, little more than 25 pages of glossy, self-congratulatory rubbish.
Well, I think that the contrast between that report and the reporting done by the CPA and the U.S. Embassy is so striking that what you end up with is a sort of publicity document for AID that disguises all of the issues. The fact of the matter is we didn't do very well with the aid program last year in terms of allocating it. This year, with $18.4 billion, we were, according to last report, under $500 million of actual expenditures and spending out at a rate of less than $20 million a week. Now, that may sound like a high amount of money to some people, but for a country of 26 million people, and when if you look at the figures, the areas we're unable to spend in are virtually every area of democratization, education, attempts to improve the justice system, and so on, it's pretty discouraging. So is the fact that the UN has at least temporarily concluded it can't find a single country that is willing to provide it with security forces, and it isn't coming back, at least in the near term.
And there was much hope of it coming in to help with elections. Rod Nordland, looking at armed conflict again for a moment, let's pull the lens back from Muqtada al-Sadr's sort of ragtag, but nevertheless, pretty troublesome group. Overall, in the 5.5-6 weeks since the interim government came to power, what's the picture with insurgency in Iraq? Steady, reduced, increased? We see U.S. casualties up in July from 42 in June to 54 in July. But overall, how's the insurgency going?
Well, if you look at the numbers that the U.S. issues in its own sort of internal reports and so on, they've been fairly steady. There hasn't been a dramatic change, but still at a fairly high level. However, I think a lot of those numbers are suspect, and my anecdotal sense is that there's been a great increase. So certainly there's been an increase in attacks on Iraqi forces and Iraqi security forces, a determined effort to show that they can, by the insurgents, to show they can't do the job, and also a sense that they're the easier target, and they're more in presence on the streets now, and they're getting hit a lot more. That's discouraging, I think, for a lot of the Iraqi police and a lot of the Iraqi forces. I think there's a growing sympathy among a lot of policemen and Iraqis for the insurgents. You even hear policemen sort of congratulating them when they make a successful attack on Americans. And these are all very, very worrisome trends. Things are not getting better by a long shot. Just to go back briefly to what Mr. Cordesman said about the rate of expenditures, I think it's even worse than the numbers suggest, because of the money being spent on reconstruction. Most of that, or not most of it, but a very large proportion of it is going to security, to securing the projects themselves and protecting the foreign workers and so on, rather than making any substantial contribution to reconstruction of the country itself.
Leading the conversation about that reconstruction, as Anthony Cordesman describes it, to be characterized by half-truths, propaganda, self-delusions. Chris Albritton, also in Baghdad. So there's Muqtada al-Sadr's group. We've got a description of the broader insurgency from Rod Nordland. What about the Sunni areas of the country, where the U.S. seems to have withdrawn its troops in Fallujah and elsewhere? What's going on in Ramadi, in Fallujah? You tell us where else. Who's in control of Iraq now?
Well, in the western areas, there's a good question about that. A lot of the U.S. troops are kind of hunkered down. They're letting the Iraqi forces go out more. In Fallujah, the Mujahideen and the police go on joint patrols. I mean, Fallujah is basically a no-go zone for, Westerners of all stripes. Every day we're seeing reports that come in from the embassy and from CPIC that, one or two Marines are killed every day in Anbar province, which is this huge province stretching from just west of Baghdad to the Jordanian and Syrian border, and that covers a lot of ground. It almost seems like they have basically kind of just ceded control of a lot of areas of this to kind of keep their own casualties down, and it's a power vacuum that the insurgency is more than willing to step into. You have an element of foreign fighters, you have Baathists, you have nationalists, they're getting money in from inside, they're getting money from the Gulf states through the Sunni mosques. They have a variety of tactics. The Americans are not in control out there, it doesn't appear, but it doesn't really seem that the insurgency has completely solidified control either, so it's a bit of a stalemate.
And Rod Nordland, looking at the insurgency, it's a big word for many parts at this point, but how would you describe it as the elements of it? Foreign elements, domestic elements, subsets within the domestic insurgency? Paint us a bit of a picture, if you would.
Well, I mean, it's hard to give a definitive answer. I think it's all of the above, and the argument is really over how much of what proportion those various elements have. It's certainly clear that the trouble is not all foreign terrorists or al-Qaeda or Zarqawis and its fellows, although they certainly are a factor. Largely speaking, it's an indigenous insurgency. It's Iraqis who were sympathizers with the previous regime, were holdovers and diehard Baathists, but a lot of new blood as well, particularly in the West in areas like Fallujah and elsewhere in the Sunni Triangle, in cities in the north like Samarra and Baqubah and Balad. There's a lot of new blood, and they just could not be mounting the level of operations that they are without a lot of support from a wide swath of Iraqis. I don't think it's anywhere near a majority, but it's a large enough number that it's worrisome and getting very much worse.
Anthony Cordesman, we've just got a minute before we'll take a brief break, but if you step back and look at this insurgency, how do you characterize it? What kind of strategic challenge is this? We of course, Americans remember Vietnam. We've read about Algeria. What's the shape of this challenge now in Iraq?
Well, every insurgency is different, but several key factors are very clear. The new government does not yet have popular legitimacy. The Iraqi forces for the government are far too weak to be able to establish security against any level of insurgent movements. And we are dealing with a very diverse, divided group of insurgents, as was pointed out, largely Iraqis, but there's no central structure to attack. They're innovative, they're adaptive, and the very fact there are so many diverse groups means that if you attack one successfully, the next emerges. Furthermore, since the start, it's been clear we're not reducing the number of insurgents. If anything, the attackers are recruiting more, they're becoming better trained, and they're becoming more effective.
We're going to come right back and look at all of that. Anthony Cordesman in Washington, please stand by. Rod Nordland with Newsweek in Baghdad, and Chris Albritton with Time magazine in Baghdad. Please stand by. We're talking tonight about the status of U.S. efforts in a bloody Iraq. We'll hear in a moment from U.S. troops just back from the front. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking tonight at the status of U.S. efforts in a bloody Iraq, and we'll be hearing soon from U.S. troops just back from the front, from the longest-serving U.S. unit in the country. I'm joined tonight from Baghdad by Rod Nordland, Baghdad bureau chief for Newsweek magazine, also from Baghdad tonight by Chris Albritton, reporter there for Time magazine, and with us from Washington, D.C. tonight, Anthony Cordesman, senior fellow and security analyst at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Chris Albritton, Anthony Cordesman, just taking us in there to some of the challenges ahead. I wish you could give us a snapshot of this new government in power now since in power, in quotes, to some extent, I guess, since June 28th, headed up by Ayad Alawi. The opening weeks showed a kind of muscular, confident government there. Then these reports about Alawi's own background characterized some places as a thug, true or false, I don't know. But just in terms of effectiveness, how is it doing? Is it governing Iraq? Is it like Hamid Karzai in Afghanistan, just governing the capital?
Well, whenever I talk to the Interior Ministry, they have a very charming spokesman, and he always tells me, come back in 3 months or 2 months or whatever the time frame is.
Right.
It's always come back later, and we'll have this problem licked, whatever the problem is I'm calling him about. Alawi came out swinging very early on. One of the very first things that the government did was declare that it could declare emergency law, and then it did nothing to actually declare emergency law.
Mm.
And it seems to me that with Muqtada running around and Fallujah still, a boil waiting to be lanced, then there seem to be some pretty good areas where this law could be applied. But they don't seem to really want to do it, probably because they don't actually have the muscle to back it up. And the Americans don't really want to be seen as enforcing, martial law when they came here to, install democracy and liberate the place. So it seems that there was a lot of heat and noise at the beginning, but Alawi's been out of the country for the last 13 days, I believe it was, which has sparked some grumbling among some Iraqis that I know that he's scared to stay in his own country, which is a bit like what Karzai did in Afghanistan early on until he finally just wised up and hired American security forces. Yeah, the general idea is that the electricity is still bad, the water is still bad, the sewage in Sadr City is still bad. It's only been 2 months, so you have to be fair in that sense. But the general impression is that they've waited 16 months and nothing has changed. And whether there actually has been change or not, it has been so gradual or so incremental that the average Iraqi is not seeing it. And so the perception is that the government is not governing. It's just doing whatever the U.S. tells it to do.
Rod Nordland, what about that perception? At the factual level, do we have a kind of Potemkin government here, or is it beginning to get its feet on the ground, its hand on the controls?
I think I kind of disagree with both your other guests that it's not certainly the government does not have the force to project a control and authority, but I think it still does have a certain reservoir of goodwill from Iraqis who are happy to see a government of their own of some form, and also still prepared to blame whatever the problems, the many problems that still exist, on the Americans. And there's a kind of, they're willing to kind of separate those two things in their minds at least, and all the things that are wrong are the fault of the Americans, and whatever hope they have, they're kind of investing in this new government for the time being. I don't think that can last, and the government's going to have to show some concrete results, and it's been off to a very slow start in terms of getting things done. I mean, they haven't even managed to figure out a system for issuing new weapons permits to people that are allowed to have weapons, so that every person in this country carrying weapons now is doing so illegally, which is a fairly important matter when you consider that, everybody working on reconstruction, all the foreigners here, everyone else, needs guards and so on who need weapons, and if they can't get a little thing like that together, you can imagine how much trouble they're having much bigger things. But I think there still is a reservoir of goodwill towards the government on the part of people, and people like the tough talk. I mean, they want to hear tough talk from their leaders. They're fed up with the violence and everything else, and so far that's playing pretty well. They enacted this new security law, martial, you know, gave themselves the right to declare martial law in effect. And I wouldn't be surprised if we don't see that actually put into practice. There's some thought that Alawi might announce that even tomorrow, at least in certain areas of the country, probably Najaf and a few other isolated areas. So we'll see how it goes.
Anthony Cordesman, you write that it's time to move away from the sort of propaganda, half-truth, self-delusion into a sort of real-world sense of what's going on in Iraq and the challenges there. How do you see the main challenges for the interim government, for the U.S. at this point?
Well, I think in the case of the interim government, one of the greatest challenges is that it was given authority and a transfer of sovereignty long before it was given the resources to fully function. It isn't a matter of it being unable to govern. It was thrust into governance at a point when most of the programs that were supposed to equip it and made it ready simply had not yet been implemented. Those programs, frankly, need to be rushed forward. And the government needs to be given the kind of authority to run its own aid programs that we have so far deprived it of. One of our great reasons that the economic aid program has failed so badly is that for all the limits in the government, this EPA, USAID, and the sort of integrating U.S. contractors have been a disaster. They simply can't get the money out, and when they do, far too often, it simply isn't what the Iraqis need. For the government to govern, we have to be able to give them aid, move the money forward, help the economic climate. And similarly, on the military side, what Iraqis have said again and again they want most is security. The element of the new government that they have said they want most to have in place are the police and the security function, and that's the only element of the government which in the public opinion polls to date has had broad support.
But you're writing that while the raw manpower numbers there for those Iraqi security forces are impressive, that in fact they're not well placed to deal with an insurgency that you're saying may go on well into next year, maybe several years after.
Well, let me be very careful. I'm not saying that. These are all taken from U.S. government figures and from reports that go back to all of July 13th, and if you look at those numbers, you see basically that even the regular military have only about two-thirds of the weapons requirements they need and half the vehicles, 20% of the body armor, and none of the key communication systems that the U.S. has said are necessary. Now, those requirements were issued long before we asked those forces to do the insurgent role. If you look at the security and the police, you see they have about 40% of the required weapons and a third of the vehicles and about 25% of the body armor. Again, these are all official figures. And those figures, again, were based at a time before the new government wanted these forces to take on sort of SWAT missions and other very demanding counterinsurgency missions. And if you look at the training levels, you see that the training program, if it's a matter of giving people 2 weeks training, hasn't done all that badly. But if you actually look at the number of people who have the kind of training they really need, the figures are almost glacial. Now, if that is the official set of numbers on these, the fact of the matter is that General Petraeus and the mission he's been given need to be boosted. The kind of contract barriers that have really prevented people from getting the money they need to be eliminated because we're right back to Vietnamization. We tend to get into positions where we're only prepared to succeed after we've already lost.
Anthony Cordesman, I'm sure American citizens listening will find this confusing. It is clear that we need a successful outcome here. It would seem to be clear that President Bush needs a successful outcome here, and yet you're describing Iraqis simply physically not put in a position to succeed. How do you explain that disparity?
Well, I think that the way many people who are U.S. military advisors would explain it is that basically they were given the mission of training Iraqis for a climate in which the United States expected to defeat this insurgency as early as last September, and certainly no later than January of 2004, in which the regular Iraqi military wouldn't have to fight the insurgents. They would basically simply be a force that would be on the borders defending against foreign threats, and the police and security forces would be dealing more with the problems of theft and looting than a nationwide insurgency mission. And as a result, basically speaking, we wasted nearly a year in refocusing the kind of training effort that was really required. Now, in April, General Petraeus was given the mission. It's not clear that he's been given the resources. But until April of 2004, we really didn't focus on making the Iraqis ready or capable of dealing with the kind of situation they face.
Let's turn back to Baghdad. Rod Nordland there. I don't know what the depth of your interaction is with U.S. officials and U.S. military at this point. We know that at formal briefings, they always convey confidence. Outside the briefing room, what are you hearing? Do they feel like they and the Iraqi interim government, their allies, are getting on top of this, that they've got the right plan, the right resources, or not?
Well, it kind of depends on what level you're talking to. When you're talking to higher officers, I think they're all on the party line. But when you talk to officers further down the food chain, I mean, they're all kind of pulling out their hair at the lack of resources, even for the American military. We did a cover story profile of Petraeus recently. I spent some time with him, and he at that time, that was just a month ago or so, was talking about not really being able to hand over very much to the Iraqis for quite some months, or maybe even as much as a year. But at the same time, there's incredible political pressure, I think, to put a lot more of the responsibility on the Iraqis and do that as quickly as possible. And that's what we've seen happen in the last month. And I think somewhat to the peril of the overall mission, because they've been taking very high casualties. They're not making any progress against the insurgency. They're perhaps changing the nationality of the body count a little bit, but not in any way that's going to help the overall result. And I think there's a sense that I have is that we're just kind of muddling along, you know, trying to keep U.S. casualties as low as possible with one eye on the elections in the states and just get by somehow without any real well-thought-out plan of action.
To that very point, Chris, Albert Britton there in Baghdad, I don't know what extent you're able or people there are keeping up with the presidential campaign back here and the GOP and Democrats, Kerry and Bush, going back and forth over Iraq. To the extent that you can, does the debate over where things ought to go, need to go there, does it sound relevant to the challenges on the ground in Iraq?
No. No, I don't think so. I mean, the Bush administration seems to basically, as Rod was saying, just kind of like muddle through, keep the casualties low until November, and something will happen. But they don't seem to kind of have any real plan for it. On the Kerry side, I don't really know how his plan differs that much. I mean, I've kind of looked at it, but they seem more or less the same. Bring in some more UN forces, bring in allies, but there's no real plan for actually doing that. And as I think was mentioned earlier, the UN hasn't indicated any preference for coming back, and no one's come up with no one's volunteering any bodies to step into this mess. No, I mean, the election year politics are kind of talking over the real problems, which are that there are not enough troops to provide, you know, either Iraqi or American or both to, you know, kind of get a handle on this insurgency. The hearts and minds of the Iraqi people have been lost pretty much for good, I believe, from the Americans. Any kind of goodwill that might have existed there is pretty much gone. The interim government still has a lot to prove, and I think that from the people I've been talking to, that the goodwill is rapidly leaking away. I don't see any of these problems really being addressed in the presidential debate.
I wonder, Chris, what's your sense of how U.S. troops in Iraq are dealing with this? They're reading the magazines from back home, getting now and then, I suppose, to see television. I've got a Knight Ridder report here recently talking with U.S. troops beginning to question the mission and the vision that they've been sent out on. They quote a Staff Sergeant Sheldon Rivers saying, "I'm tired of every time we go out the gate, someone tries to kill me. That can't be a comfortable position." Do you still feel troop confidence in the mission?
Well, I mean, I'm hearing a lot. I don't know that it's so much that there's a lack of confidence in the mission so much as a lack in confidence in the command, in the civilian command. I was up at Camp Cook around Taji the other day, and I was talking with some troops, and people who had voted for Bush in 2000 are planning to vote for Kerry, not because they particularly think that Kerry's a better commander-in-chief or anything, but they're just tired of there being no apparent plan other than just kind of like go out, try not to get killed, and then come back, and then do it again tomorrow. They're losing, I think, a sense of what the mission was for. They're not seeing the progress, just like the Iraqis aren't seeing the progress, the American troops aren't seeing the progress that they want to see and that they thought they were here to do. And I think these are fairly apolitical officers. These are not guys that, are active in politics back home when they're not on their when they're not doing the reserve or their National Guard drills.
Rod Norland, remind us of the steps that are supposed to be taken immediately upcoming toward democracy and elections in Iraq. We've had a canceled national conference. When is that supposed to come back? Are things more or less on track toward a vote at some point?
Well, no, everything's not on track. I mean, they're supposed to have a national conference. Originally, that was supposed to be convened in July. Now it's put back sometime in August. It'll probably get put back some more as well. That would be a kind of national parliament or an advisory body that would be broadly representative. And the hope was, at least on the part of Brahimi from the UN, that that would even bring in some of the resistance elements. We're a long way from seeing anything like that happening. Getting a UN presence back here, which would require some kind of protection force, it looks increasingly unlikely that any other countries will pony up troops for that. The U.S. may have to do it, and whether that again will leave the U.N. in the position of looking like it's a partner with the U.S. and kind of undermine their credibility as they seek to organize elections. The U.N. has said all along that you couldn't have elections unless you had an improvement in the security situation. Well, we've seen, if anything, a security situation as bad or even worse than it had been when they said that. So whether they can even meet the deadline of holding elections by January. And then if they do go ahead and have elections, how are they going to protect the polling places? Because it's very clear that the insurgents will attack polling places all over the country. And will people come out in enough numbers to make the election credible? That's a very big question. So on all those measures, things look pretty dismal. I think the only kind of broad good news is so far we haven't seen the country start spiraling into civil war.
And we'll have to go out on that point of good news, such as it is. Rod Norland in Baghdad, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
My pleasure.
Rod Norland, Baghdad Bureau Chief for Newsweek Magazine. Chris Albritton, reporter for Time Magazine in Baghdad, thanks to you for being with us. And Anthony Cordesman from the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. Great, as always, to have you along. Thanks so much for your time this evening.
Thanks, Tom.
Great to have you. There, a status report, and in a few minutes we will hear directly from U.S. troops just back from the front from the longest-serving U.S. unit in Iraq. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking tonight about the state of the U.S. and interim Iraqi government efforts in Iraq. We turn now to two U.S. soldiers lucky enough to be back from Iraq just this week, safe and sound. Their unit is the 94th Military Police Company of the Army Reserve, and they came home Wednesday after serving a twice-extended tour in Iraq as members of what has been, until this week, the longest-serving unit in the country. We're glad they're back. Joining me now from Pelham, New Hampshire, is Paul Benoit, Sergeant in the Army Reserve's 94th Military Police Company. Sergeant Benoit, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
And from Hollis, New Hampshire, Stephen Whitridge, also a sergeant in the 94th. Sergeant Whitridge, welcome home.
Thank you.
Stephen Whitridge, to you first. There's a lot we want to hear about life in Iraq, but just being back after all those months, 20 months active duty, 15, almost 16 in a combat zone, how does it feel to be home?
Oh, obviously it's pretty good.
A big crowd came out to meet you. People had waited. There were many previous times you were supposed to come home. You were extended twice. When did that happen?
The first time was in, I believe it was around September. Sergeant Benoit can correct me if I get that wrong. We were in country for approximately 6 months, and word came down that it was going to be a 1-year total boots-on-the-ground extension. And That was a disappointment, but it was nowhere near as much of a disappointment as being extended after the entire year we spent there in April.
This was Easter time. You were supposed to be home again, and it wasn't to be.
That's correct.
Paul Benoit, welcome home to you as well. What are your first hungers back in America? What did you miss?
Mainly, I just missed my friends and my family, and got to spend some good time with them. It was great.
That's fantastic. We're delighted that you're home. 5 Purple Hearts in your unit, but no casualties, Stephen Wittridge. And yet, you guys served in Ramadi, Fallujah, tough area, escorting all kinds of groups out on dangerous roads. How did it happen that you managed to get through all those months that we've painfully watched U.S. casualties from this side without any casualties in your unit?
That's a very good question. We were asking ourselves that very same question while we were waiting to board planes. You know, how is it that we made it through when so many other units took casualties? I don't have an answer to that. I think it was a great unit. I think we all went out of our way to be alert and to appear that we were alert, which I think was just as important as being alert, with how the enemy perceives you. But I don't have a good answer to why. We didn't have any deaths.
Paul Benoit, 166 soldiers deployed in the unit, 166 coming home this week. That's pretty great. What do you chalk it up to?
I'd have to chalk it up to the same things Adam Wittridge said. It's not like we weren't doing any of the dangerous missions, because we were definitely on the forefront and definitely had our chances and took our fair share of hostile fire. So I think it's just, it is a good unit, and we take care of each other, and that's the only way I can perceive that.
Stephen Wittridge, take us in to your function, your role there in Iraq. I guess the joke in your unit was that MP stands for multipurpose these days in Iraq, because military police are doing so many different things. Give us a sense of the range of tasks that you were assigned in Iraq.
It just went all over the gamut. I guess the primary thing we did was what they call movement and mobility support operations, which isn't just one thing. It consists of all kinds of different things, convoy escorts, clearing the roads, checkpoints, all kinds of things where you're in your vehicle with your team and your squad and you're out on the road looking for the bad guys or keeping the good guys safe. And we did that all over the place from the very beginning. The first thing I did there was a checkpoint all the way to the end, and the last thing I did was convoy escorts.
And now we hear, of course, about all these terrible kidnappings, not just soldiers, but truckers of many kinds. The roads seem like some of the most dangerous places to be in Iraq, Paul Benoit, with all the bombs at the roadside and everything else. What was it like being out posting guard or serving guard duty on convoy, on the highways?
Yeah, the highway is definitely a dangerous place. It could get kind of scary. You never know when something like that's going to happen. And, some of the roads are the most dangerous, probably because the enemy knows, you know, which routes we take. And you're definitely more alert in some areas than others.
How often were you taking fire when you were guarding convoys, Steve Wittridge?
We were fairly lucky. We took fire a few times, but I think on the whole we were taking fire, or at least my squad was taking fire, less often than we did when we were out west in the Ramadi, Fallujah, Al-Assad area.
And of course, that's Sunni area. When were you there?
Earlier in the deployment, we started. All the platoons were split up. My platoon started in Ramadi, went to Fallujah, went back to Ramadi, and then went to Al-Assad after about, I think it was 8 months or so. And it was fairly, when we were in Fallujah especially, we took fire pretty much every time we went out the gate. Ramadi was probably in, I don't know, 30%. You go out 1 in 3 times, you'd take fire.
Okay, let's get down to the questions that I'm sure your relatives, if they haven't asked already, they're going to want to ask you, and your friends back here. Just simple questions. American listeners want to know, Stephen Wittridge, let me put it to you first, is this thing working? Did you feel in Iraq like you were part of a project that is moving towards success or not?
That's a very difficult question to answer, because I really didn't get a good feel for the whole picture. I could only see my piece of it. as far as my piece of it goes, that's still hard. I'm not sure I can answer that definitively. Is it working? I know that we did our best to get our mission done, and you know, we accomplished our missions. I can't speak for the other guys if they're getting their mission accomplished.
And Paul Benoit, what about your sense of this thing? We know that you all went over, you did your duty. We heard the accolades that your commander, Major General Dennis Leitch, gave when you come home, and everybody's back, glad that you're back home safe and sound. But within your platoon, within the part of the unit that you worked in, you know, what's the lowdown here? Do your comrades, your buddies there, think that the U.S. effort in Iraq is working?
I'd have to say that since we were there for so long, we've seen so many different stages that the first half of our deployment, things were looking good, and we had workers coming in and repairing one of the major dams in Iraq, and we had schools going, and then the insurgency rose, and then I think that's where everything starts to be questioned after that.
The insurgency has been there and has been pretty hot for a while now. You may have heard us earlier in the hour quoting soldiers saying they were worried. Every time they went out the gate, they felt like a target. Did you have that sense as an American soldier there of a bullseye on your back?
I always knew it's possible, and as Sergeant Richard said, we were security for convoys, and the only thing that would run through my mind is if we ran into that situation is that none of those truckers would be kidnapped or hurt.
That's the job. That's what you were focused on.
That's the job, and that was my focus.
And Sergeant Wittridge, did you interact with Iraqi security forces at all? Of course, the new interim government is installed there now, and there's been a big effort to train up Iraqis, police, and more. Did you have interaction with them?
I had a little bit of interaction with them. At one point, our platoon was involved in training the Iraqi Border Patrol, and that was where I had most of my interaction with the Iraqi security forces. But my particular job in the academy didn't involve the actual training, but I did have a little interaction with them.
And what's your sense of their attitude, their competence, their readiness to step up and take over at some point the kinds of roles that U.S. soldiers like yourselves have been filling?
Well, I can only give you my opinion on that from what I've seen, which is they undergo a fairly short amount of training. It's like 2 weeks, 3 weeks. I'm not sure it's adequate to the task, especially given the difficulties that highly trained soldiers like Americans are having over there. Furthermore, there's the additional difficulty of questionable loyalties. Sometimes you wonder about them, whether they're just there for the money and that they're not going to risk their lives to accomplish our mission.
Paul Benoit, how about your sense of Iraqis, either in security or even more broadly, Iraqi civilians? Did your relationship with them change during the many months you were in Iraq, and how was it when you left?
There are some people that do want us there, and they're happy that we are there. But, again, you have to question their loyalty because they're very persuasive type of people. And as far as the police go, I don't know if their heart is actually in the job or if it's just a way to make money.
Sergeant Benoit, let me ask you, you're home now. It's a great week. Everybody's celebrating, and you've been, I'm sure, had a big smile on your face ever since the plane took off from Kuwait. But there must have been some tough times for you in Iraq as well, and we don't want to ignore those. What were your hardest days, nights, moments in Iraq in all those 15, 16 months?
Basically, the troop morale throughout our deployment is just highs and lows, like a roller coaster ride. And every time an extension came down, you get that low point. But after you get through that, you get 6 more months to make it or however long you get to go, and that's your next focus point. You just drive on and focus on what you got to do to make it home.
And Sergeant Wittridge, there's the emotional high and low hinging, and we can totally feel it on when you'd get out. But what about your most challenging moments, maybe not exactly in terms of getting out, but in terms of dealing with what you were confronted with? When was it toughest?
Well, we had a very good sense of what places were very dangerous and which places were not quite so dangerous. And my toughest moments for me was when a mission would come down saying, you're going to go to this place, which is extremely dangerous. And I just thought, oh, God, all right, I got to brace myself for this. Yeah. You know, once you do, you're good to go. You go out, you do it. But when it first comes down, you just say, oh, no, I hope I don't have to go there. I hope they cancel it.
Mm-hmm. And yet you would have to go.
Yeah, usually.
I wonder about the reception since you've come back and your conversations with people. Paul, I know on the later on this month, your folks plan a big party down at the Elks Lodge, and Stephen Wittridge, I'm sure there's plenty of celebration of you coming back as well. What kind of attitude are you sensing among Americans back here, friends and family, about the effort in Iraq? They're clearly supportive of you. Do they seem supportive of the ongoing effort?
Right now, I'm pretty much overwhelmed by the people that I've come across, friends and colleagues. They seem very supportive of me, and I'm more than happy. As far as their views on Iraq, we haven't really discussed that.
Steve Wittridge, how about you? Have you sat down and had people ask you what you think of it, or have they told you what they think of the U.S. sticking in there, for how long it should stick in?
Well, I think everybody's been very, very supportive, and the people I tend to know and talk to tend to be a bit more conservative. And most of their opinions are that, regardless of whether we should have gone in the first place or not, and there are differing opinions on that, we're there now, and we can't leave now because the consequences of leaving now are vast. Of leaving Iraq in a state of anarchy, it would turn into another Afghanistan as it was before we got involved there.
It's easy for them to say, in a way, sitting back stateside. Do you feel the same, having had your hide on the line all those months?
Well, unfortunately, yeah, I do. I think the consequences of leaving now, just cutting our losses and going, are too great to do that. It's unfortunate because I wish we didn't have to have any troops there. Having been there, I think it's not pleasant duty by any stretch. But I think the consequences are too high to leave it.
We've just got another minute. Paul Bennett, let me ask you, celebrated two birthdays in Iraq. That's a long time. As I understand it, your time with the Army Reserves actually expired in April, but you heard nothing from the Army. They just left you in place. Are you going to re-up as an Army Reservist?
Right now, I have to show up to one more drill, and I have to seek the commander out. And as my time in the Army right now, I'm looking at more of shifting my focus to concentrate on my job.
That is, not the reserves, but your civilian job.
Correct.
And Sergeant Wittridge, as I understand it, you're 35 now. You've got two more years in the reserves. Do you expect to be back in Iraq? Do you expect to re-up when your time's up?
Well, what I'm looking at now is a change of job. That was the job I did over there was pretty intense, and if I have my choice, I'll do a different one if I have to go back. Looking at definitely a different position.
Do you think that reservists are going to re-up or get out?
Based on what I saw and the people I know, I think that soldiers who have been there for a long period of time will probably get out.
And we can all understand that. We are delighted that you're home, hale and hearty, and back in the USA, and we thank you for your service and your time there. Sergeant Stephen Wittridge, Sergeant Paul Benoit, both with the 94th Military Police Company this week back from Iraq. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Thank you.